Okay, well, thank you everybody for coming to our weekly seminar series. Our speaker today is James Melton from University College London. James is a lecturer in comparative politics in the Department of Political Science at UCL. His research focuses on comparative constitutional design, investigating the origins, stability, and enforcement of formal constitutional texts. James is a principal investigator of the Comparative Constitutions Project. The project received Liebhardt, Sevorsky, and Verba Dataset Award for Best Dataset in Comparative Politics from the American Political Science Association in 2013. He's also the author of the first book from the project entitled The Endurance of National Constitutions. The book was published by Cambridge University Press in 2009, and in 2010 it received the Best Book Award, which is awarded annually by the Comparative Democratization Section of the American Political Science Association. Thank you so much, James.
Okay. Thank you for the introduction, and thank you all for coming to my seminar. I know this is informal, but I'm going to go ahead and stand so everyone can see me. So the title of my talk today is Writing Rights, the Origins, Spread, and Efficacy of Constitutional Rights. And I really want to talk about two things today. First, I want to give everyone just a brief introduction to the Comparative Constitutions Project, in case you're unfamiliar with it. And second, I want to talk about the second book that's going to stem from that project, Writing Rights. And this is a book that I'm working on with Zach Elkins from the University of Texas and Tom Ginsberg from the University of Chicago Law School. So I'm going to give you just a little bit of our motivation for writing this book. And then primarily I want to talk about the spread of constitutional rights. And specifically about the effect that the Universal Declaration of Human Rights had, or perhaps did not have, on the contents of national constitutions. Now, just as a bit of a disclaimer, the research that I'm going to present today is very early research. The book is still very much in progress. So I definitely would appreciate any comments that you might have. Also, as a second disclaimer, I'm not a Latin American specialist. Zach is our Latin American specialist. I do think I have something to say about kind of the spread of constitutional rights around Latin America, but I will probably learn just as much during the kind of discussion, question and answer, as what you learned from me about Latin America. So the Comparative Constitutions Project started back in 2005 with Tom, Zach, and I kind of sitting around a coffee table at University of Illinois. And in the last 9 years, we've collected a lot of data on constitutions. So the goal of the project is to catalog the contents of all constitutions written in independent states since 1789. And there's three different, or sort of distinct data collection projects with this project. The first is to build a chronology of constitutional events. So I went through the historical record for every independent country in the world from 1789 to the present to identify all the constitutions written in those countries and all the amendments to those constitutions. And that's what's illustrated in these two figures here. The figure on the left are new constitutions, and the figure on the right are constitutional amendments. So we've identified roughly 900 new constitutions that have been written over the last 225 years, and more than 2,500 constitutional amendments. The second phase of the project...
Sorry, in the past 25 years, you said?
225 years.
Could you tell us what the years are?
Yeah, so this is 1800. Sorry, these are kind of small. So this is 1800 over here, and this is 2000 over here.
And then in between you have... I was just seeing where... Yeah. Is it 1950 before the 2000?
Yeah, so they're in 50-year increments.
50, okay.
And then here we have the number, so 60s at the max and zeros at the bottom. The darker gray now overlying this, which almost completely overtakes the light gray, are the number of texts that we found. So for every one of those events, we've had to go through and find the constitutional text, either the full constitution or the text of the constitutional amendment. We found almost all of them. We found more than 95% of the constitutional texts and the amendment texts. And the third phase of the project is to survey the contents. And this is the phase where we're very kind of actively coding still. We developed a survey instrument of 669 questions covering all aspects of modern constitutions, from the structure of the documents themselves to the structure of government and the powers that government has that are provided those documents to the Bills of Rights. And here, this darkest gray is the amount of coding we have done. We have some data for almost all constitutions that we have text for. And we're kind of filling in the amendments as we go along. So that's where most of the coding work we have to do is coding those constitutional amendments. Now, in terms of constitutional rights, in our survey, we ask about 117 distinct constitutional rights. And we have binary data on all these rights. The rights either in the Constitution or it's not. There's a few of them, like, for instance, the right to health care, that we have more than binary data. But for the purposes of today's talk, I'm going to be dealing with all binary data. So for right to health, we specify not just if the right's included, but we have a secondary category if it's freely provided as well, for instance. So overall, we have a huge amount of data on rights. If you stack it all up, we have more than 1.5 million country right years. So we have a lot of data to sort through. And that's, I've been trying to analyze this to figure out how rights have spread around the world and spread across different regions for about the last year or so now. And that brings me nicely to our motivation for writing this book. Now, rights have always been a core feature of constitutions. So there's been hardly any constitutions written that contain no rights. There's only 10 or 15 out of the 900 in our sample that have, we can literally not identify a single right in. And you can see over time, the number of rights in constitutions has expanded dramatically. Thank you. So the first constitutions, on average, contain fewer than 20 rights. And constitutions written today contain more than 60. So there's been a threefold increase in the number of rights included in constitutions over the last 225 years. And this kind of goes right along with theories of what a constitution is and the functions of a constitution. As Hardin and Breslin say, one of the primary functions of a constitution is to limit government, and the primary tool available to constitutional drafters are these constitutional rights. It's a direct limit on the power of government in most cases. Now, our motivation for the book is that this is actually, there's actually a little bit of a puzzle here. So despite the importance and the prevalence of constitutional rights, there's a lot of skepticism about their utility. Okay? So this, perhaps the most famous skeptic is James Madison, who talks about constitutional rights as parchment barriers, suggesting they're no stronger than the parchment upon which they're written. More recently, Walter Murphy and David Law and Neil Verstig have referred to constitutions in authoritarian countries as shams, exactly because they don't abide by the rights that are set forth in the Constitution. And Nathan Brown has referred to Arab constitutions as non-constitutional, suggesting that while the structure and the powers of government may be described adequately in those constitutions, the constitutional rights are virtually meaningless. So there's this puzzle that constitutional rights take a central role in sort of the discourse about constitutions. And when we think about the functions of constitutions, this primary function is to limit government. Now, the puzzle is that despite their prevalence, most people are fairly skeptical about constitutional rights, which leads to the research questions that we want to address in the book. So if these rights are meaningless, why do states entrench them in their constitution in the first place? And the second is, once entrenched, under what conditions, if any, do these rights effectively limit the behavior of government? So those are the two primary research questions we're going to address in the book. And today, I want to talk a little bit about the spread of constitutional rights. And specifically, I ask the question, are rights protected by the Universal Declaration of Human Rights more likely to be entrenched in national constitutions? And there's good reason to believe that the answer to that question is yes. So for instance, in Beth Simmons' I think it's 2009 book on the Universal Declaration of Rights, her argument is largely that the UN Declaration of Rights is enforced at this sort of domestic level. And one of the reasons for that is that it changed the way that it changed the contents of the constitutions, that those rights in the UDHR are much more likely to be found in constitutions. And you can see the basis for her argument in this figure. So the solid line indicates the proportion of the sort of expected proportion of constitutions with rights in the UDHR, and the dashed line is rights that aren't in the UDHR. So you can see that rights incorporated in the UDHR are much more common than rights that aren't in the UDHR. The problem is that the rights that were selected
to be included in the UDHR aren't selected at random. So there's this change in the discourse about human rights at the end of World War II. And it's hard to tell whether or not this difference reflects the difference in the change in that discourse around that time, or that the UDHR is having some sort of independent effect on what's in constitutions. Okay? And this figure illustrates that point quite acutely. So the dots here represent different constitutions. And each dot indicates the similarity between the rights in that constitution and the rights in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Okay? The trend is this squiggly line here. So I've estimated a change point model on that trend to determine if there's any systematic shifts in similarity to the UDHR. So what the model does is first, it looks for how many shifts there's been, and it I set the parameters such that it can find up to 10 different shifts. And then after it determines the number of shifts, it figures out, well, when did the shift take place, those different shifts take place. It only found one shift, and the shift was in 1943, 5 years before the UDHR was written. So what this suggests is that the content of constitutions already changed prior to writing the UDHR, which is an indicator of the sort of endogeneity problem that I've been talking about. Okay. Oops. Too far. So, moving from the data, so that's sort of the problem that we're trying to address in this particular chapter, trying to figure out the effect of this international human rights regime on constitutions. Now, moving away from the data for just a moment and talking in theoretical terms, there's a couple of reasons to think that the UDHR might have had some sort of effect. The first rationale is from the international relations literature, and that is that all these domestic actors, they want to conform with these international norms, and that UN Declaration of Human Rights is a statement about the international norms surrounding human rights, at least at the time when it was written. And so if states want to conform to those international norms in terms of their rights protection, their domestic law, they should entrench those rights in the UDHR in their constitution. The other argument would be a more domestic argument, more comparative politics argument, and that is that the UDHR forms this focal point. It creates a great amount of awareness about the rights that are entrenched in it, and this increased awareness leads local interest groups, domestic interest groups, to push for the inclusion of those rights in their domestic constitution. So there's kind of two different rationales for why you might expect there to be this relationship. But I think there's actually more reasons to think that there shouldn't be such a relationship. The first is that many constitutions already had those rights entrenched in them as of kind of 1948, when the UDHR was signed. Another reason is that there might be some countries, especially during the Cold War, that are shielded from that international pressure. They don't feel that pressure to conform to these international norms. Right? And so this is the sort of age-old argument that the Soviet Union and America protected some of these countries from that international pressure, right? Or at least, and certainly they didn't bring pressure to bear on these countries. They were trying to recruit allies. They weren't trying to change those allies' behavior necessarily, especially in terms of human rights. Another reason why you might not expect a relationship is international norms might change. So the UDHR is a static statement. These are the norms in 1948. But in 2012, I don't really expect those international norms to be the same about human rights. So it might have been some change over time. So this would suggest a hypothesis that if there is an effect, it should be early on in the period, in the sort of 1950s. And then the last reason is that the UDHR might violate some sort of domestic norms. And so you hear this often in the case of Asia. They don't share the same sort of Western liberal democratic values, and so they don't feel the need to put all these rights in their constitutions. They have this more kind of Confucian societies that they don't believe in the specific set of rights that are in the UDHR. So their rights may look, in their constitutions may look slightly different.
Oh, Islamic ones as well.
Yeah, Islamic ones as well, yeah. Okay, so this brings me back to the analysis and the research design. So, as I already mentioned, the rights included in UDHR are not random. And so that means that there might be some endogeneity if we just look at this bivariate relationship between the UDHR and what rights are in constitutions today. So we need to identify some sort of strategy to overcome this endogeneity. And our strategy right now is to try to identify rights that had a high probability of inclusion in the UDHR but were excluded, sort of accidental exclusions, you might say, or rights that had a low probability of inclusion in the UDHR but were included anyway, sort of accidental inclusions. So since, and then we ask the question, since 1948, did the trajectory of those rights that are unexpectedly included or excluded in the UDHR change? And just to give you an example of what we're talking about, we're actually going through all the minutes of the meetings about the drafting of the UDHR to try to find rights like right to petition that was literally accidentally excluded from the document. So this is the first example we found. We're hoping we can find some more that are sort of like this. It was literally accidentally omitted. So what do I mean by that? Well, during one of the drafting sessions, when they're talking about the right to petition, there was widespread agreement around the room. I think there was 14 delegates or something like that during this in the drafting committee. Every one of them just knew they wanted right to petition in the UDHR. But they couldn't agree on the wording. And their worry was that if they included a right to petition, people would interpret that as a right to petition the UN. And they didn't want people from all over the world petitioning the UN. And they wanted to allow people to petition their local governments, their domestic governments, but not the UN itself. And so what did they do at the end of that session? They tabled the right because they couldn't agree on the wording, and they put it at the end of the document and as an unnumbered article. Okay, and they said they'd come back to it later. The problem is they never came back to it. And so in one of the final drafting sessions, someone brought up, hey, what about right to petition? We all agree this should be in there. But they agreed on all the other articles already. And so they said, we can't undo all this work to add this particular right. And so they left it out completely. Now, this is perhaps surprising in Latin America. You can see the right to petition is extremely strong up until the sort of 1948 when it's drafted. And then it sort of drops off in the 50s. In Europe, the time trends, it may be a slight increase, but it's more or less constant across time. And that's sort of the general pattern with this right. It's decreased almost 20 percentage points in its prevalence since the UDHR was drafted. So this is perhaps some anecdotal evidence that the UDHR was effective, at least for this, or that the UDHR, I guess the thing to ask is what's the counterfactual? If it was included in the UDHR, would you have seen this drop off, right? Or would you have seen increases in Europe? We don't know with one right. So we're trying to collect data on more rights to kind of tell a little bit of a qualitative story here about what happens to these rights that get excluded or included from the UDHR. We're also going about this using some statistical analysis. And so that's the part of the research that I'm going to mostly be presenting today. And in that statistical analysis, we're going to separate out regions, and we're going to separate out and look for different time trends. So we think it's really important to look at regions very specifically here, because the early analysis that we've done with these data suggests that there isn't some universal or global trend in constitutional rights, that it's much more regional stories. Like every region has its own rights story. And so we're going to focus here on the European and Latin American constitutions in this particular paper and for the remainder of this presentation. And we think this is nice because it restricts the sort of cultural and institutional variation that might affect which rights are included in constitutions and countries' willingness to adopt those rights in the UDHR. Also, these are the only two regions in the world at the end of World War II that have this sort of established menu of constitutional rights. So they, especially in Latin America, most countries have gone through numerous constitutions by 1950 or so, and they have this set of agreed upon rights in those constitutions that's evolved over almost 150 years. And the same can be said for most of the European countries as well. So I think this is important. It's not really fair to start in Africa where most of those countries become independent in 1960. It's really hard to separate out, well, what rights would have emerged in Africa if the UDHR wasn't present and starting to look at that. So we think this is a nice strategy for untangling the effects of this UDHR. We also want to look at time trends. So this is an analysis I did for another chapter. And you can see on the y-axis here, or x-axis is year from 1800 to 2000. And on the y-axis here is the number of rights. And this is the number of rights in the median constitution. So what do I mean by the median constitution? It's in a given year, it's the number of rights that are in more than half of the constitutions in force around the world. Okay? And I did a similar sort of change point analysis here, the whole purpose of this was to test the three waves of rights argument. So you can see we find four different waves of rights in constitutions. But the important thing for this particular seminar is what happens at the end of the Cold War. Okay? So up until the Cold War, there's less than 20 rights that are sort of widely agreed upon that are in more than half the constitutions. At the end of the Cold War, that number almost doubles. Okay? So there's this fundamental shift in terms of which rights are included in constitutions, how much agreement there is about the rights in constitutions at the end of the Cold War. So I want to be careful to try to disentangle that effect in the statistical analysis. So I'll be stratifying the sample in a couple of different ways and testing for sort of time trends. I also had that hypothesis earlier that if the UDHR is going to be influential, it's going to be early on in its life period, before when those international norms are crystallized around sort of what's in the UDHR. Okay, so I have a couple of different empirical models or quantitative models that I'll be using here. The first one is an endogenous treatment effects model. So the main model is this top one. And so what I'm looking for here is a change in the prevalence of a constitutional right. So the unit of analysis here is the right. So there's going to be 117 observations in all of these models. And what I'm looking for is the change in the percentage of constitutions with that right from 1946, which is T0 here, to some future period. I'm going to use the years 1980 and then 2012. And so there's some covariates in my model. There's the baseline level. So this is the percentage of constitutions with that right in 1946. And then T is the treatment. This is whether or not the right is in the UDHR or not. And then the secondary equation is sort of like a two-stage least squares estimator. This is just a binary variable. It's coded 0 if the right's not in the UDHR, 1 if it is. The same covariates as the first equation plus some instruments. And I'm using two instruments here. The first instrument, both of these should be correlated with inclusion in the UDHR, but importantly, they shouldn't be included, or they shouldn't be correlated with the dependent variable from this first equation. So the first instrument has to do with the proposals to the drafting committee. So there was three or four countries, and probably, I think there was 10 individuals and organizations that actually submitted proposals, full written proposed Universal Declaration of Rights to the drafting committee. And so what we think that is capturing are the sort of sentiments about constitutional rights. So the more proposals that contain a specific right, the more that right is part of this international consensus about which rights are proper. That's in some ways a signal of those international norms. So this affects the UDHR. It shouldn't necessarily affect that trajectory because I'm going to be controlling for that through another variable. The other instrument is about political power. So this is the number of Permanent Security Council members that have a right in their constitution. So those are my two instruments.
Could you walk me through the dependent variable again? Why do you exactly choose these two points in time? You just briefly mentioned 1964 and something else.
Yeah, so T0 is 1946.
Okay.
So I want to choose something before, right immediately before the UDHR was written. So I want to know what's in constitutions right before it's written. And then the later periods are more random, I'll admit that. One is the present, right? So there's two different periods. So it's the change from 1946 to 1980.
Why that?
There's a couple of reasons. First, it's sort of random, and I have tested some other years, and it doesn't make much of a difference. But the reason I chose 1980 is because it's fairly interesting in terms of Europe and Latin America. So it's It's right in kind of the middle of the Cold War, so it's after the last Soviet constitution was written, and all the kind of Eastern European countries had their most recent round of reforms. It also gives some time for like other European countries to amend their constitution, like Sweden amended its constitution in the late 1970s, to adjust to these practices, because they don't get amended very often. And Latin America, it's right before the sort of democratization of the third wave. So I want to capture what those authoritarian countries did in their constitutions. And you might be a little skeptical, well, who cares about what authoritarian constitutions do? But if we're going to see an effect of the UDHR, that's where we should in some ways see it the strongest. Because for them, inclusion of these rights really is sort of costless. If you assume that the judiciary isn't there to enforce them, that the people are already repressed. So they should kind of adopt these things in UDHR much more strongly than, say, a Democrat, right? And I'll provide some more evidence for that later on. So there is some purpose to it, but it is sort of random, I'll admit that. And sort of next steps for this paper, it's thinking about this particular analysis, how can I get rid of that sort of element of randomness a little bit? But this is a first cut. So the first results are predicting the contents of the UDHR. So this is my first stage model. I included a number of variables beyond this. I'm just going to, in particular, I included fixed effects for the category of rights, so as a civil right or economic right or social right, etc. So this top one is the number of proposals and those kind of independent or individual proposals to the UDHR drafting committee. That's strongly correlated with the rights in the UDHR. The Security Council, this is significant at a 0.1 level, not a 0.05 level. And this one is also significant. So what these numbers indicate is the change in the probability of entrenchment in the UDHR for one unit change in the independent variable. So for every proposal, it increases the that includes a specific right, increases the probability that right will be in the UDHR by about 0.1. And for every member of the Security Council that has a right, at least in Europe, it increases by about 0.13, it says. Now, this here is the change leading up to the ratification of the UDHR. So from 1900 to 1946, the change in the percentage of constitutions around the world that have that right, and there's no effect here. And this is this particular variable, this is why I get differences between these two equations. This is the regional prevalence. So this is the proportion of countries in Latin America or in Europe that have that right and the effect. And it doesn't have any effect, but just that small difference changes the equations a little bit. And the reason I include that is because that's going to be an important variable in the next stage.
Can I ask what the definition of Europe is in the Cold War?
And I include Eastern Europe in that. So, and this is the effect of the UDHR on constitutional rights. So, remember, the dependent variable here is the increase or decrease in the percentage of constitutions that have a right between this period. Okay. So, what we see here is that, let's say in Latin America, if a right's in the UDHR, it likely increased by about 15 percentage points in terms of how prevalent it is in Latin American constitutions over this period. And it's about 14 percentage points over the same period in Europe. If we look at the later period, the whole period from 1946 to the present, the effect is statistically insignificant. The coefficient decreases a little bit and becomes insignificant. So what this suggests is perhaps some early evidence that this UDHR, at least, was most important in affecting constitutions early on in its lifespan, not later. And then this REG HRI is the regional human rights instrument, so the American Charter on Human Rights, the European Covenant on Human Rights. So that's so what we find is the American Charter has a stronger effect than the European one. The European one only has an effect in this later period. I think that makes some sense. The European Union got much stronger at the end of the Cold War. In general, it's gotten stronger over time. So we're seeing that here, where it was probably relatively weak early on in enforcing this. And then this, the other variables here, this is that change in the the percentage of countries with each right from 1900 to 1946. So if a right is on its way up in that early period, it's likely to continue to rise in these later periods. And this is sort of a regression towards the mean sort of thing. So this is the level of each right in 1946. So if a right is in 90% of constitutions in 1946, it doesn't really have anywhere to go but down. Right, so that's what this effect is. That's why you see strictly negative effects here. Okay. Are there any questions about these results?
Just wondering why 1946 for Europe, because the European Convention on Human Rights wasn't even there in 1946. So
yeah.
It comes later.
Yeah. So
I just wondering what if any?
Well, the American Charter comes much later, right?
Right.
So it's hard to say that it could have had an effect. In some ways. So I take this into account into the next analysis better. And these, in some ways, you could cut it out. Perhaps what this is suggesting here is that the same sort of endogeneity that I've been talking about, right? So it could be a sort of reverse correlation in a way. So these rises here are actually predicting what's going to be in this American Charter and similarly over here, right? So. I'm not entirely convinced by this particular part.
So is it rough and ready?
What?
That measure. I'm just worried about the kind of consequences that come from that.
From including it? I've done it without that, and it doesn't seem to make too much of a difference. What do you mean rough and ready? Like it's,
well, if the convention wasn't there, and the date concludes that period, and countries that clearly couldn't be in it at that time because it didn't exist.
Yeah. Yeah, not sure.
Just not a statistical measure of how rough and ready it is, and then what value was predicted, you know. But it's a thought.
Yeah, no, it is a thought. I mean, this is sort of like the next stage is, we think that these regional treaties matter a lot more than the UDHR. Mm-hmm. That's sort of our initial hypothesis, because we see such strong regional trends and rights. And so the next part is sort of endogenizing this one, too, and treating that as an endogenous variable. Because right now it's treated as an exogenous, and it's clearly not, right? So that's sort of a next step here. One of the interesting things is how little correlation there is between the UDHR and some of these regional instruments, right? So you see lots of things that weren't in the UDHR that are included, and some things that are omitted as well. So I don't have a real good response to your question. Sorry.
Yeah, I just was curious. Are you comparing a constitution in 1980 with a constitution in 1946 and not any constitutions in between 1946
right.
and 80 that
right.
met?
So this is a very static analysis.
So you can't account for all of the
changes
political
in
changes
no.
during
mm-hmm. that the next model will do that better. So the reason for this model is it's really hard to make one document endogenous in a model like this, right? So the way I've done it here is by treating this as a cross-section, right? Because this literally is a cross-section. This model here is a cross-section. So how do you take that cross-sectional model and put that into this dynamic process which is going on up here, right? That's really tough. And if you want to treat this as endogenous, okay? So that I'm still working out sort of the statistics about how to do that. In some ways, the best way to do that. Okay, one of the interesting things I find is that the endogenous. So I can test if the UDHR is endogenous or not in this model, and depending on the covariates included, which is perhaps what you'd expect, it may or may not be endogenous. So if I take this out of the model, the UDHR looks like it's endogenous, but this seems to be having some kind of huge role because it's no longer endogenous once I include that. So I'm trying to determine if this is sort of the omitted variable that makes the UDHR endogenous, or which would mean I don't have to worry about it, or if this is sort of driven by multicollinearity, because as you can expect in a model with 117 observations, there's a high degree of correlation. And that test statistic to test the endogeneity is heavily influenced by that sort of multicollinearity. So I'm trying to determine how big of, if the multicollinearity is driving this result by including this extra variable, or if this is actually kind of standing in a proxy for these kind of global trends and whatnot. It looks like it's sort of like global trends, right? So that's what I might not have to worry about the endogeneity if I can make that argument. Yeah, that was, I think, the face that I made as well, skeptical.
You make the argument that it's global.
What?
That the trend is global. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. Well, that...
Then...
That,
you say?
Yeah. So this trend is... There is a global trend in terms of international human rights, I think, at the end of World War II. Or at least a sort of Western trend, right? Yeah. But these are the rights that are important. To say that it's global is a bit of a stretch, but I'm focusing here on those sort of Latin America and Europe, which are the more kind of Western countries. Okay?
Two quick questions to see whether I understand the first line, which is, in a way, the most important.
Right.
So how many more... What was the share of constitutions approved between 46 and 80 compared to 80 and... Are the observations more or less similar?
No, not at all. There's a ton of constitutions written between like 1985 and like 2005. There's just a ton of constitutions, yeah.
And that would mean that there's less, so that actually there's less rights in that more recent constitutions that are...
There's less rights that are in the UDHR, right? That's what we're fighting.
But no less rights overall.
No, there's not less rights overall for sure.
Okay, so there's less more other types of rights.
Yes.
Can you give us some idea of what those might be, the non-UDHR rights?
Well, okay. Non-UDHR rights. So, I already said right to petition. There's also some criminal procedure rights that don't make it into the UDHR as well. I think presumption of innocence in trials, I want to say.
Economic, social, cultural rights.
Yeah, there's a lot of social and economic rights that didn't make it in, that subsequently made it...
ICCPR is it?
Yeah. Yeah, that subsequently made it into the international covenant, right? So those were pretty controversial.
And can I also, in the same vein as Lee asked, what are the rights that are normally dropped in recent years?
Yes. So... There's a couple of interesting trends. Petition is one that's interesting, right? It sort of drops out. Another interesting one is...
not in the... No, I mean...
Rights that were in the UDHR that
dropped. Yes.
I don't know that answer. I guess press. So press has this kind of precarious position in the UDHR where it's kind of given, but it's given in this very vague way. But that's... So it is technically in there. But that drops after the UDHR. Yeah.
So could this effect be driven not so much to things that were in the UDHR that were dropped, but things that were included that are not in the UDHR?
Hmm. Yeah. And that's what I'm going to show you in a minute.
Because that would be a different causal... So that suggests the causal
story...
So it suggests the causal story is probably something to do with the Cold War.
Yeah.
And that these countries are allies of the Cold
War.
That's
the next step.
Okay,
so let me keep moving.
Sorry.
Finish up here. So the next step is... to exactly try to get at this more dynamic story, right? And so here, I actually have all of my dimensions of variance in this model, right? So Y is whether or not a right's entrenched in some constitution written in some year, okay? And then I have some covariates, I have a random effects term for the constitution, and then an error term. So the dependent variable here is going to be binary.
So what are C, what are E, and what is T? Sorry, just to have an idea.
C is the country,
yeah.
R is the right, and
okay.
T is the constitution.
So it's not time.
Well, it more or less is time,
okay.
Because they're written in different years. I have a T here because I can't have two C's, but
C1,
C2. Yeah. It's more or less, it's sort of a stand-in for time in a way, right, because they're written in different years. So one thing that's interesting I didn't mention earlier, if you do like an ANOVA analysis of these data, just including those three factors, not looking at like factors between multiple units, I can explain like 40% of the variance, and 25% of the variance is at the rights level. So most of the variance here is in rights, it's not across constitutions. And so when we start looking across constitutions, I think it's close to 10%. or something like that. So most of the variance here is in rights. It's not in constitution. So that was another rationale for looking at rights as a unit of analysis in that previous one, because ultimately, in some ways, I think that's what we have to explain the most in this book, is why do we see so much variance in rights? Why do some rights get picked up and other ones don't? That's a very important question that isn't really addressed very much, at least in the political science literature. So here's the results of that equation. And these are the average results. I'm going to show you something that's more compelling in a moment. And so each of these is the change in the probability of entrenching a right in some constitution, given a unit change. So you can see both the UDHR and the regional human rights instruments are no longer statistically significant. And in this one, for the regional instruments, I actually am controlling for time. So the American Charter doesn't enter until like 1969 or 70, whenever that was written. And similarly in Europe. RegPrev is the regional prevalence. So at the time of drafting, how many other constitutions in that region, what percentage of constitutions in that region also have that right in their constitution? This is one of the strongest predictors. The other real strong predictor is, what's the right in the country's previous constitution? We observe a huge path dependence here. So even if you completely replace the constitution, if that right was in the previous constitution, it has about a 1/3 likelihood of making it into the next constitution as well. And if you combine these two, if it's both regionally prevalent and it's in the previous constitution, it's almost for sure going to be in there. Like, I think it's around 95% of the time. The other effect here is democracy. And these coefficients are the same, and this one's just below statistical significance. But democracies, rights have about a 0.03 chance of making it in. So if you generalize this across all 117 of our rights, democracies have 3 or 4 more rights than non-democracies in their constitutions, on average. But the model's actually more complicated than that, because I've interacted the UDHR with time. And I've allowed for this break to occur in 1990, just to see what happens. So this is the effect of UDHR in Latin America. And so what you see here, well, these are the non-UDHR rights, and these are the UDHR rights. It's very hard to tell, but this line's actually slightly above this line early on in the period. So that's maybe the effect that we found previously. But for the most part, they look pretty much the same. So these rights here look pretty much the same as these. The difference is this has a lot higher slope than this one. So these non-UDHR rights are the ones that are being incorporated, okay? And that's why you're seeing that effect change in the previous figure or in the previous table. So this is the situation in Europe. Here, this line's clearly higher than over here. That's the effect.
Can you come back to the? I'm sorry if this is very basic. So Basically, the story is that the share of UNDHR rights are going down because the share, because
of,
the number
of non-UNDHR rights is going up. Yeah.
Not because they are less.
And this is a predictive probabilities. I should mention that, hence the confidence intervals. Mm-hmm. So that's the story. I should have just said that earlier, because I knew this was coming. But I think there are reasons to think that some of those rights have become a little bit less popular, but not very many of them.
So when I ask you which ones are dropped, basically none are dropped.
Yeah, well, I could think of the press. That's what I can think of. that's more or less the story. And the story is more or less similar here. The difference is that over here, this is actually decreasing over time, right, in Europe. And then these two are more or less the same. Okay, so that's those are the early stories that I have. If you look at the American Charter, there's basically no difference here. Like it says, it shows that there's basically no effect at all, from what I can tell. And the same with the European Covenant. And I can't quite figure this out, because this should actually be quite important. And what I suspect is happening, and I thought it would be particularly important in Eastern Europe. But Eastern Europe's really a funny case. So if you remember that, I've been looking at sort of these regional patterns, right? And so in one of the things, there's a couple interesting things that came out. So what I looked for first was regionally, which rights were in half of the constitutions? What I find is that only 14 out of our 117 rights are in more than half of the constitutions across every region of the world. So only 14 rights. But if you look at the rights that were only in more than half of the constitutions in one region, there's like almost 20, right? So there's this sort of strong regional pattern where there's certain rights that are really popular in one region and nowhere else. But then I looked at it even closer, and the region that those rights are popular in, like 13 out of the 20, is in Eastern Europe. So Eastern Europe has a lot more rights in its constitutions, and there's agreement. I mean, those rights, those 13 rights are in like 90% of the Eastern European constitutions.
Post-Soviet.
Yeah, the post-Soviet. Yeah, so this happened in roughly 1990. So this is talking about today.
Right.
Okay? So what I suspect is that that's what's driving this similarity here, is that not only did they incorporate these European covenant rights, they included everything else as well, right? So they just have a lot of rights in their constitutions. So concluding remarks, did the UDHR affect domestic constitutions? My early answer to this is a little, and mostly in the early years. What we haven't done that we need to do is look at this more on a right-by-right basis, or perhaps even categories of rights, to figure out if there's some heterogeneity. Because I know that there's some rights in the UDHR that really took off, and other rights that didn't take off. Right. So if we look at the back at that sort of analysis, the median constitutions, of the rights in the UDHR, there's like 50 rights in the UDHR.
30.
Huh?
30.
Depends on how you count it.
30 articles.
Yeah, 30 articles, but there's more than one right per article.
Okay.
And so if you look at the UDHR, like 30 of the 50 rights or something like that is in that median in 2012, where there's 20 that aren't. So there's 20 rights that never really took off. So there is some variance within rights here that we need to explore. The other question, the more general question, why entrench rights in national constitutions, I've got kind of three answers for that based on that second model that you saw. First, the right was in the previous constitution, so there's a lot of path dependence here. The other is that the right is popular in the region. There's some sort of regional diffusion going on that we need to explain. And if we throw in something that measures like global diffusion, we find nothing, right? So there really is a regional story here. And this is true across regions. It's not just in Europe and Latin America. There's some regional story going on here about these rights that we're still trying to kind of pin down. And the last is right that if the Constitution is written during a period of democracy, there's a few more rights. And this is interesting. So we've explored this in another paper. And one of the things we do in that paper is divide rights into core rights and peripheral rights. Core rights are in more than half the constitutions. Peripheral rights are in fewer. But even if we relax that assumption and just look at rights, there's this nice kind of curvilinear relationship in a way that democracies, they're much more likely to entrench these rights that aren't very popular, where authoritarian regimes are much more likely to entrench the popular rights. Okay, so there's, perhaps not in this chapter, but somewhere, there's a sort of domestic pressure story. So we're gathering a bunch of data on the groups that are involved in constitutional drafting. And we want to test this. Tom has this insurance theory for why states entrench judicial review. But we think that same sort of story probably operates in terms of minority rights, and the rights of minorities or the rights of certain interest groups. So I think that if there's more groups involved, democracy is a nice proxy for that, but it's not a perfect proxy. If there's more groups involved in the drafting process, I think you're going to get more rights. So that's something that we have some kind of anecdotal evidence for now. That's something that we want to test, and it's just sort of present in that model. So thank you very much. There's a lot more data and stuff at the Comparative Constitutions Project, so I look forward to the discussion.